from Wilmington, still something of a mystery to the Carolina coaches, was headed to Five Stars Pittsburgh 2 camp to see how he stacked up against other players from across the country, players who had actually made their varsity teams as freshmen and sophomores and distinguished themselves. The conventional wisdom was that the best young players had already been identified. Jordan had been nervous heading into Carolina's camp, but that was nothing compared to the tension he felt over the five-star camp, where he would be measured against elite talent. The players in the Pittsburgh 1 session were supposedly the best, but Session 2 in Pittsburgh also included 17 high school All-Americans. On that list was Wichita's Aubrey Sherrod, whom many scouts considered the best wing guard in that class of rising high school seniors. Jordan worried about competing against top players, but Pop Herring told him to relax, that he would be fine. Still, Jordan found it hard to relax when he first surveyed the busy scene at Pittsburgh's Robert Morris College, where the five-star opened in late July. The place was packed with a throng of 150 coaches and scouts who were there with clipboards taking note of each player's flaws and assets. From 8 o'clock until 11 o'clock on Five Star's first night, the players were thrown into pickup teams to play informal games so that the coaches of the camp's 12 teams could select players. The camp's top-level league was known as the NBA. As a newcomer, Jordan was far from guaranteed an NBA slot. It would all depend on how he played that night on outdoor courts, his least favorite way to play the game. "I was so nervous my hands were sweating," he recalled. "I saw all these All-Americans, and I was just the lowest thing on the totem pole. Here I was, a country boy from Wilmington." Under the NCAA rules of the day, college coaches were allowed to participate in the All-Star camps as coaches and counselors. Brendan Malone, a smart, tough assistant at Syracuse University, had been working the five-star camp for several years. The previous summer, his team had included Aubrey Sherrod and a highly ranked center, Greg Dreiling, and they had won the camp championship. Coaching the team to the camp title was an honor for the aggressive Malone, just the kind of distinction that an assistant coach needed to boost his career. For the 1980 camp, Malone again planned on drafting Dreiling and Sherrod, with his eye on another title. In particular, Malone held the first pick of wing players in the draft and knew Sherrod could provide his team the scoring it needed to win another title. But the day before the camp's opening, Malone had to return home for a brief family emergency. So he asked Tom Konchalski, his good friend, to watch the opening night tryouts and draft the team for him. Malone left strict instructions for Konchalski to select Dreiling and Sherrod. Konchalski was prepared to follow Malone's instructions that night until he saw an unknown player from Wilmington. "What I remember is he had a great jump stop," Konchalski recalled. "He could stop on a dime, could really elevate, go straight up, and get really great elevation on his jump shot. There was no three-point shot in the game then, so he didn't have extended range, but he had a great mid-game and a great jump stop. He would explode into his jump shot to the point that players were defending his belly button. He just was so explosive athletically." Over the decades of Garfinkel's five-star camp, there had come into being a phrase for the very best of the best, the sort of extremely rare talent that just leaps out at observers. It was what we called one-possession player, Garfinkel explained. A one-possession player means that all you have to do is see them once. Garfinkel was sitting in his office watching the first games through a window when he first noticed Jordan. He goes up for a jump shot. There's three players guarding him. He goes up for a jump shot, and there's nobody in the air but him. He's all alone. He's up in the air, and like that, he's spectacular. My gosh, Garfinkel thought immediately, this is a one-possession player. Jordan, too, could sense immediately that he had something the others didn't. "The more I played, the more confident I became," he remembered. "I thought to myself, maybe I can play with these guys." Suddenly, Konchalski had a decision to make. Should he draft as Malone directed, or should he take a player who was unlike any player he'd ever seen? Malone showed up early the next morning and went directly to Konchalski, who was having breakfast in the camp cafeteria. He said, "Show me my team," Konchalski recalled. I said, "I got number one." And he said, "You got Dreiling?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You got Aubrey Sherrod?" And I said, "No." And he said, "What do you mean?" Aubrey Sherrod was considered the number one shooting guard in the rising senior class at that time. I said, "I took a kid from North Carolina." Garfinkel laughed as he recalled the exchange. Brendan says, "Who the hell is Mike Jordan?" And he goes ballistic, only he didn't say hell. He goes berserk. "What did you do to me? Who's Mike Jordan?" Tom told him. "Relax, relax, he's a great player." Brendan's all steamy, he walks away. He's all pissed off. Malone didn't remember the sequence just that way, but he did recall it only took one look at Jordan to calm him down. "I remember the first time I saw Michael," Malone said. "We were at an afternoon game that day. Michael was on an open court, asphalt, and he was moving. And the way he moved was like a thoroughbred, his stride, just the graceful way he ran and cut. He was a standout right away. You could look at him, look at how he moved and ran. It was apparent to even a person who didn't have a sophisticated eye. It was apparent to you right away that Michael was superior to the other players in the camp or that were playing high school ball at that time." Legend has it that a few days into the camp, Jordan scored 40 points in one half of play, all of 20 minutes. "What really got me is that he couldn't be defended," Konchalski recalled, "because he jumped over people and had a nice touch. I mean, he could get his shot any time he wanted." Anthony Tichy from Goldsboro was also at the camp and recalled that it was Jordan's competitive nature that pushed him so far above the others. "He got the top 72 players in the country at the time," Tichy explained. "So everybody had their moments during that week. He just happened to shoot up the charts that one summer." Garfinkel realized he should phone Dave Kreider, a friend who edited Street and Smith's yearbook, the major preseason publication in college basketball in that era. The magazine listed 650 high school seniors as top prospects. "Dave," Garfinkel asked, "where do you have Mike Jordan on your list?" Kreider supposedly checked the list and reported there was no Mike Jordan, only a Jim Jordan. Garfinkel then advised Kreider to add an extra Jordan somewhere high on the list. "I called Street and Smith to get him first or second team preseason All-American," Garfinkel said. Kreider replied that it was too late, the magazine had already gone to press. Garfinkel told Kreider he should do something because it would be embarrassing not to have a major player like this Jordan kid listed. "In those days, they'd print it weeks ahead of time," Garfinkel recalled. "Dave told me, you will not see Mike Jordan's name in the top 650 players of the Street and Smith's preseason magazine." Kreider later revealed that his North Carolina writer for the 1980-81 edition didn't even include Jordan among the top 20 juniors in the state. Everywhere Jordan went in the camp, Roy Williams was there, following him with a mix of anxiety and elation. "Every time we went to stations, Roy Williams was at the stations watching," Malone remembered. It was apparent North Carolina had identified him as an outstanding player, even though he only played 1 year of varsity ball in Wilmington, North Carolina. "What I truly remembered about Michael is that during that week, everybody was kind of awed at his driving the ball because that's what he did best back then. He would scissor kick on the way to the basket, hitting an extra stride to accelerate past defenders," Malone recalled. "He was going to the basket hard. Everybody was in the lane and packing it in trying to stop him." Jordan led Malone's team to the NBA title that first week. "The last seconds of the championship game, I called a timeout and told them the game was on the line. I said, 'Michael, you have to take this game over.' He was very receptive to coaching. And the next defensive sequence, he put his hands on the ground like he was determined to stop the guy he was guarding. That's when Malone realized that Jordan's competitiveness might be even greater than his abundant athleticism." He was the co-outstanding player of the week with a player named Mike Flowers from Indiana, and he won the MVP of the All-Star game, and he got several other awards, Garfinkel remembered. Jordan was injured for part of the second week in Pittsburgh and had to sit out a number of games. "What happened was he hurt his ankle and he only played half the games," Konchalski recalled. "He ended up being the MVP of the All-Star game for the second week in a row. He didn't get the most outstanding player, that was Lester Rowe, a kid from Buffalo who later played for West Virginia. He was about 6'4", 6'5". He won because he played the entire week." "I got 9 trophies," Jordan proudly told the Wilmington Journal upon his return home. Jerry Wainwright, who was then a high school coach, had witnessed the breakout performances. At the end of the second week, when the campers had just about all cleared out, Wainwright heard a bouncing ball in the gym and found Jordan there pushing himself through full-court shooting drills. Wainwright, who would later coach at UNC Wilmington, asked Jordan what he was doing. Wainwright recalled his reply, "Coach, I'm only 6'4 and I'm probably going to play guard in college. I've got to get a better jump shot." The five-star camp had quickly opened a new chapter in the Jordan legend. "It was the turning point of my life," Jordan reflected. The experience served as another reminder of how rapidly fortunes change in athletics, a truth Jordan had first learned with Babe Ruth baseball. Early success was no guarantee of anything. "Coming into Pittsburgh 1," said Tom Konchalski, "Linwood Robinson was the guard that was North Carolina's prime target, more so even than Michael Jordan. They thought he was going to be the next Phil Ford, but he would get injured in high school. He had surgery on his knee and he was never the same player. he never had the force he once had. Dean Smith stuck by his scholarship offer for Robinson, although the player never found success at that higher level. Robinson eventually transferred to Appalachian State, where he played well but never fulfilled the Phil Ford comparisons. Jordan's biggest trophy coming out of five-star was a newly hatched reputation. Even his own family now saw him differently. Up until the camps, James Jordan still imagined his son's future as a baseball player. After the camps, those thoughts began to recede, Michael acknowledged to the Wilmington Journal. My father really wanted me to play baseball, but now he wants me to pursue basketball. Indeed, basketball was now pursuing him, something that baseball never did, no matter how tightly his father clung to that dream. Garfinkel began spreading the word that Jordan was one of the top 10 national prospects in the high school class of 1981, which was led by a young center from Massachusetts named Patrick Ewing. Rick Ettinger ranked Jordan as the second best rising senior behind Ewing. But analyst Bob Givens took it one step farther and rated Jordan the top player nationwide, even ahead of Ewing. I had gone to several of his games during his junior year, and I was there at five-star, Givens recalled. You can't believe how I was ripped for ranking Jordan ahead of Ewing. Everybody said I was taking care of a hometown boy. The dramatically upgraded rankings brought recruiting interest from hundreds of schools, and North Carolina just as suddenly found itself competing with a variety of programs for the affection of the chosen one. Over the years, Dean Smith had learned to be cautious with recruits, but now it seemed he was going to pay a price for that. To me, when you see something like Jordan's talent, it stands out, Brendan Malone observed. I'm surprised that they had to make up their minds. Was he worth a scholarship? I would have pounced on him right away the first time I saw him play. Malone later made a phone call to Wilmington in an effort to recruit Jordan for Syracuse. Despite his high regard for Malone and the experience at five-star, Jordan politely declined, saying his interest was elsewhere. Like many, Malone assumed that Jordan meant he was a lock for North Carolina. But Jordan's thoughts had turned away from Carolina. Part of his hesitation was driven by doubt. Everywhere he went, he encountered people in Wilmington suggesting that his eyes were bigger than his talent, especially in regard to the Tar Heels program. The people back home, stardom was the last thing they saw for me. People said I'd go there, sit on the bench, and never get to play. I kind of believed in myself. The circumstances left him musing about his options. If North Carolina was this hot after him, why not look at other schools that really interested him? Larry Brown had just coached UCLA into the national championship game. Jordan loved what he saw in the Bruins that spring. I always wanted to go to UCLA, he explained later. That was my dream school. When I was growing up, they were a great team. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Walton, John Wooden, but I never got recruited by UCLA. Known as a coaching gypsy, Brown was already looking for his next job and on his way out after just 2 years at UCLA. He would leave the school at the end of the 1981 season. Plus, Brown had played for and coached with Dean Smith. Jordan didn't realize it at the time, but it was unlikely that Brown would have stepped in to take away a prized local recruit from Smith. Another option, one that wasn't disclosed publicly at the time, was the University of Virginia, where freshman sensation Ralph Sampson had just taken the Wahoos to the championship of the National Invitation Tournament in New York. Jordan could see himself fitting in well there. So he contacted the Virginia coaches. I also wanted to go to Virginia because I wanted to play with Ralph Sampson for his last 2 years there. I wrote to Virginia, but they just sent me back an admission form. No one came and watched me. In a 2012 interview, Terry Holland, then the coach at Virginia, acknowledged Jordan's interest, adding that his coaching friend Dave Odom had been among the talent evaluators looking at Jordan during Garfinkel's camp. I know that Dave Odom was impressed by Michael at the five-star camp the summer prior to his senior year, Holland recalled. Up until then, Michael was pretty much a late bloomer. We had already committed scholarships to Tim Mullen and to Chris Mullen at that position and were in pretty big battles for both with Notre Dame, Duke, and St. John's. But it looked good for getting both, so we elected to focus on them to protect the recruiting investment we had already made in them. We got Tim but lost Chris to his hometown team after a huge battle. Michael has told me that he liked our team and was hoping that we would come after him hard, but he has never indicated that he would have chosen UVA over UNC. The Virginia coach couldn't have known how unwise it would be to dismiss the Wilmington player's interest. Michael clearly kept the snub in mind for his future meetings with the Cavaliers. Virginia's decision not to recruit Jordan would loom over the coming seasons as North Carolina and Virginia battled for supremacy in the Atlantic Coast Conference. In 1981, Virginia beat Carolina twice, and both teams met again in the semifinals at the Final Four in Philadelphia, where the Tar Heels finally prevailed. Years later, Jordan would reveal to Sampson that he had been eager to play alongside him. The 7'4 center had spent 4 years in college trying to win a national championship for Virginia. "It is what it is," Sampson said stoically when asked about the missed opportunity to have Jordan in a Virginia uniform. "I appreciated the teammates that I had." Many years later, Howard Garfinkel would produce a book about his memories of running the five-star camp, of which the greatest were the discovery of Michael Jordan. Garfinkel had not visited with Jordan often since those summer days in 1980, but he took the book to an NBA arena one night where Jordan was playing, with a plan of giving a copy to the star after the game. Garfinkel had waited a half hour in the crowd outside the locker room and was about to give up, he recalled. All of a sudden, a little kid comes running down the hall and says, "Here he comes, here he comes." Sure enough, down the hallway comes Michael Jordan. "So I step out. I make my Jack Ruby move and I step in front of his entourage. But two of the largest cops I've ever seen are in front of him. Jordan's in the middle, and two cops are escorting him down the hallway. I step in front, and the cop shoos me away. And he says, 'Don't touch him, please. No autographs, no autographs.' So I step aside, and Jordan goes by. But out of his peripheral vision, he sees me and yells, 'Stop! That's Howard Garfinkel. He's the reason I'm here.' That's not true, of course. I'm not the reason. But that's what he said. Swear to God." Chapter 10. The Michael. So many college campuses across the land offered the same basic mix of musty old brick buildings with the fluted columns and tree-lined sidewalks, filled with the graceful forms of coeds moving back and forth to classes. But he saw that if you lingered in Chapel Hill, there were things to be treasured. The way the fall sunlight dappled the yellow leaves of the oak trees in the quad, the sight of students lazily stretched out on the library steps with books in their laps, the thump of rubber basketballs filled with too much air beating rhythmically on the asphalt of an outdoor court. It would be the small things that he treasured as he clicked along on his bicycle at an unfettered pace in the hazy dream that was undergraduate life. Yes, other schools offered similar allure, but there was no place that seemed to put these elements together quite like the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He didn't realize it at the time of his visits in the fall of 1980, but he was selecting the place where he would spend the last days of his true freedom before success took possession of his life. UNC would suit him well. At least, that's what he concluded after he visited there in a loud, trash-talking appearance that brought chuckles to those who remembered his skinny figure bouncing down the hallways of the athletic dorm. Patrick Ewing, a 7-foot Jamaican from Boston, the most heralded recruit in that year's senior class, met Jordan for the first time that weekend in October when they made their official visit to the Carolina campus. Years later, Ewing smiled at the memory. "He was talking a lot of junk," he recalled. "He was talking how he was gonna dunk on me. He talked smack from that moment on. He always had that swagger." "I remember Michael's recruiting trip well," agreed James Worthy, a Tar Heel sophomore at the time. "You heard him before you saw him." At least, part of that was his youthful fear, Jordan would admit. After all, he supposedly didn't belong at Chapel Hill, according to people back in Wilmington. He had conquered five-star. But the fear still welled up in him as he walked into the place. His doubts about the Tar Heels had started to fade once they showed interest in him. The bonding began with the care and concern shown by the coaches, and deepened as he experienced the place itself during his visits. He inhaled that elite air, and soaked in that great tide of soothing light blue UNC regalia that swirled everywhere and infused the place with a certain joie de vivre. It all helped him come to the conclusion that so many other top-flight athletes had reached over the years. "I could get used to this." Patrick Ewing had thought the same thing after meeting Jordan on that first visit to Chapel Hill. Years later, the center would reveal that he was seriously considering playing for Dean Smith until he returned to his hotel that weekend and saw a Klan demonstration nearby. That chilled any thought he had of going to UNC. If not for that Klan moment, Ewing might have joined Jordan to create an all-powerful Tar Heels team, one capable of claiming multiple national championships. Jordan may have seen the same demonstration that weekend, but if he did, it never registered. The wishes of his parents carried the true weight. His family loved North Carolina, Bob Gibbons pointed out. Just a dozen years after watching their son enter a segregated first-grade classroom in Wilmington, they now saw the state's prestigious university seeking his services. The grant in aid offered to attend Chapel Hill resonated with meaning for James and Dolores. "I told Dolores, if he were my son, I'd send him to Carolina," Whitey Pravat remembered. "That Dean Smith always impressed me as a fine man and a fine coach." As if the Jordans needed encouragement. Already bursting with pride, they thought of their son in Carolina blue and became inflated like dirigibles for the Macy's parade. And when Dean Smith and his entourage came to their home for a visit that fall, it was, as Tom Kinchowski observed with a chuckle, like Zeus had come down from Mount Olympus. Smith had a certain way of connecting with families and parents. He was as sincere as any coach could be about academics and priorities. The Jordans sat in their living room with Michael cross-legged on the floor, twirling a basketball. As they took in the message, he spun the ball slowly. There would be no promises made, Smith said. Jordan would have to earn it. It was all about the education spiel at that point, explained the writer Art Chansky. Dean knew James and Dolores were very interested in that. From the very first moments, the Jordan family saw the hallmark of Dean Smith's style as a coach, a thorough and uncommon involvement with his players as people, even as he maintained the distance and objectivity that coaching demanded. Developing a relationship with Coach Smith was probably the easiest thing, James Worthy observed, because he was just that kind of brutally honest kind of guy, very conscious of everything. He really understood where you came from. He spent a long time getting to know your parents and what they would want for their son. And that's how he related to players. Honesty is the best, and that's why a lot of players are attracted to that in lieu of all the recruitment and visits to college and stuff like that, Worthy added. It's something special about someone who kind of understands you. Despite the lack of interest from Virginia and UCLA, Jordan had entertained the advances of several schools in the region. When he visited the University of South Carolina, he accompanied Coach Bill Foster to meet the governor's family and spent time shooting hoops with the governor's young son. They weren't worried, Art Chansky said of the Carolina coaching staff, but they kind of laughed when Bill Foster, who was at South Carolina at the time, took him to the governor's mansion for dinner. So that was the kind of shit that was going on in terms of the competition. I don't think they ever really thought he was going somewhere else. At the University of Maryland, Lefty Drizel badly wanted to steal Jordan away from Dean Smith and tried to sell the Jordans on the idea that the new Chesapeake Bay Bridge had shortened the drive to Maryland into just about the same time from Wilmington as going to Chapel Hill. Jordan's parents merely rolled their eyes. Jim Valvano, the new coach at NC State, also made a pitch for Jordan and even played the David Thompson card. Valvano encouraged Jordan to think about channeling the high-flying days of his childhood hero. Well before Jordan took his official visit to Chapel Hill, he had gone there on his own to look over the place thoroughly. The Jordans came to Carolina a lot of unofficial visits, Art Chansky recalled, adding that while graduate assistant Roy Williams couldn't go on the road recruiting, he was free to entertain the Jordans on campus. James Jordan and Williams became so close that the father later built Williams a wood stove for his home in Chapel Hill. But it was the official visit that finally settled things in Michael's mind. Herring was encouraging him to get the recruiting decision made before the season started, so that he could concentrate on winning a state high school championship. Jordan's recruitment also had the potential to distract his teammates, if not the entire Laney student body. Valvano, Lefty Drizel, Roy Williams spent so much time down here we thought he was working at Laney, teammate Todd Parker remembered. Then Dean Smith showed up in his powder blue suit, and it was over. If Dean Smith shows up, Carolina really wants you. Jordan agreed with Herring. He wanted to get the decision out of the way. Carolina was the fourth school I visited, he recalled, and afterwards there was no question in my mind. I committed within a week and canceled my visits to Clemson and Duke. He made the official announcement at his home on November 1, 1980, before just two microphones supplied by local TV stations. Linwood Robinson chose the same day to announce his own plans to attend UNC, so a lot of the attention was diverted to him. Durham sportswriter Keith Drum said at the time that Jordan would be much more important to the Tar Heels program, but the assignment editors for the various media outlets must not have gotten the memo. The Jordans sat on the couch in the living room with the two microphones set on the coffee table in front of them, right there with a glass turtle and potted plant. With his mother on his right and his father on his left, Jordan folded his arms across his knees and leaned forward to confirm that yes, it was Carolina after all. His mother, who had just turned 39 a few weeks earlier, sat back, her manicured hands folded where her stylish dark skirt crested her knee. She had slimmed considerably in recent years and showed the first signs of maturing into a person quite comfortable with the spotlight her son would bring. She took in his announcement with a smile, expressing absolute rapture and hinting at all the effort she had expended to get her laziest child to this moment. 17-year-old Michael, meanwhile, appeared almost sleepy-eyed, looking into the Klieg lights of the TV crews with a calm that would become his trademark in thousands of future interviews. The slightest trace of smile, suggesting a repressed sense of glee, fell across his face as he processed the questions and formulated his answers. His father likewise sat back on the sofa, as if to take care not to invade his son's spotlight. His immense pride was tinged with a solemnity that day. He was obviously filled with an emotion that he made every effort to mask. Pop Herring was there too, standing well out of the way during the announcement, but equally full of pride. The young coach and Jordan mugged for the cameras, leaning forward in tandem to measure their hands. And later, as Jordan held a white and blue Carolina ball, the coach made as if to defend him, a playfulness born of their morning workouts together in the Laney gym. "He is like a father to us," Jordan would say of Herring in an interview with the Wilmington Journal. "We can go to him any time and talk to him about anything, things that you wouldn't tell your own parents, because he's so understanding. I think that he can lead us into a championship." Mike Krzyzewski, Duke's enterprising young coach, had hinged his hopes on Dolores Jordan's respect for the school's academics and her infatuation with former Duke star Gene Banks. Once Jordan's intentions became clear, Krzyzewski wrote Michael a letter, lamenting that he would not be joining the Blue Devils and wishing him well. The letter would resurface some years later in the Jordan Room of Wilmington's Cape Fear Museum, where it was said to be a favorite display of Tar Heel fans. Empey Park. With recruiting done, Jordan could turn his attention to his goal of winning a state championship. Laney would first have to defeat a large and physical New Hanover County team in District 1 of Southeast North Carolina's 4A classification. He played in a league, the Mideast Conference, that was loaded with talent, longtime Wilmington sportswriter Chuck Carey recalled. New Hanover had long been Wilmington's main white high school, with a tradition of athletic success led by Hall of Fame coach Leon Brogdon. It had a particularly strong football legacy, having produced NFL quarterbacks Sonny Jurgensen and Roman Gabriel. With the coming of integration, Williston, the city's longtime black high school, had been made into a junior high, a move so resented by the black community that it supposedly helped spark the Wilmington 10 incident. Racial tensions had begun to ease by the time Laney was opened in 1976 and Pop Herring was hired as the city's first black head coach. No one made public comment about Herring's new status, but all eyes were watching his progress, especially when it came to the meetings between Laney and New Hanover, coached by Jim Hebron. Michael Jordan's status as a star North Carolina recruit only served to heighten the public awareness and increase the focus on Herring. The two coaches, both in their early 30s, provided an interesting contrast of styles. The New Hanover roster of 1980-81 featured Clyde Simmons, who would later become an all-pro defensive end for the Philadelphia Eagles of the NFL, and big man Kenny Gattison, who would star at Old Dominion University, then enjoy a solid career playing and coaching in the NBA. Gattison was a junior in the fall of 1980 and approaching 6'8 and 240 pounds. Clyde Simmons was almost 6'6, well-muscled and quick. New Hanover's team included two other exceptional athletes who never gained fame, although they should have, Gattison recalled. Rondo Broney was 6'3, 215 pounds, and ran the 40-yard dash in 4.25 seconds. When he turned the corner as a running back in football, he was gone. He had the same silhouette as Herschel Walker. Ronald Jones was a 6'4 wide receiver, also with great speed. He was like Jerry Rice. Those two guys should have played in the NBA or NFL. New Hanover enjoyed a 10-win football season in 1980 with those players, who became even more intimidating when they donned basketball uniforms. By contrast, Hebron was a compact man who incessantly worked a jump rope. He loved Wilmington's beach and surfing scene, second only to his coaching duties at New Hanover. His physical education classes at the school were known for their laid-back atmosphere, but Hebron was in complete command of the team he coached. "He really was physically unimposing," remembered Gattison. "He reminded you of Dustin Hoffman. He had the most unassuming personality. He never yelled, he never screamed, but you knew the guy had your back, so whatever he asked, we just did it." While the community found Hebron interesting enough, it was Herring, the African-American, who drew the quietly intense notice. Like anything else, it was a test to see if it could work, Gaddison remembered. New racial stereotypes were being hastily drawn in those first decades of integration. For example, black athletes were almost never chosen to play quarterback, a perception that only began to change in 1986-87 when Doug Williams led the Washington Redskins to a Super Bowl title. Head coaching jobs were also often reserved largely for whites, but Herring had earned his position and had shown plenty of early promise as a head coach. His style on the sideline was animated, to say the least. If Jim Hebron was Dustin Hoffman, Pop Herring was Fred Sanford, Gaddison recalled with a laugh. Pop was a little more fiery than Jim Hebron, I can tell you that. Those were two totally different coaching personalities. They'd put those leisure suits on and go to work during games. Those were the good old days, really. Despite their size and power, Gaddison and Clyde Simmons were headed into their first varsity season as juniors that fall. In New Hanover County, you didn't play varsity sports in the 10th grade, Gaddison explained. It didn't matter who you were. When your JV season ended, if you were good enough, they allowed you to sit on the end of the varsity bench and watch. Thus, this powerful New Hanover lineup would be getting its first experience playing against Jordan in his blue and gold Laney uniform. They already knew him well due to their many battles against him in pickup ball on the city's courts, particularly at Wilmington's MP Park. It was such a close-knit community that everybody knew everybody, Gaddison explained. We always played. We played at the Boys Club. We played at MP Park. Some of the classic games that we had were outside on asphalt at MP Park. There was nobody there. He'd bring his guys, I'd bring my guys. Jordan's guys were his regular crew of Brother Larry, Adolph Shiver, Leroy Smith, and Mike Bragg. Gaddison usually showed up with his New Hanover teammates, Boney, Jones, and Simmons, who had grown up together playing sports in the city's various leagues. We had a good mix, Gaddison said of his teammates. When it came down to sheer athleticism, Michael had the advantage at only one spot. We had the advantage at the other four. We had our battles. We'd play all day Saturday. You'd play each game to 11. Somehow, at the end of those games, it seemed a lot of times that we'd be up 8-3, and then Michael would block every shot and score every point, and my team would end up losing 11-8. Whether we were playing outside at MP Park or inside Brogdon Hall with 5,000 people watching, we both wanted to win. Hebron frowned on trash-talking during high school ball. Even if the coach hadn't taken that position, the New Hanover lineup was so imposing that it tended to quiet opposing teams by its mere presence. But during and after those pickup games at MP Park, the tenor could turn a bit chippy. Adolph talked more than Mike, Gaddison recalled. A toothpick or a straw, he always had something in his mouth. Adolph was a guy who could talk, but couldn't play. When we played school ball, he's the guy who did all the talking and woofing in the layup line. But when the game started, he'd pass the ball to Michael and get out of the way. After the five-star camp in 1980, Jordan had returned to MP Park with a new sense of confidence. I'd never heard of five-star, Gaddison recalled. Michael goes to five-star and he wins every trophy up there. As usual, we meet up at the gym after he comes back and Mike tells us, "Man, you gotta go to five-star." And he said, "We have no idea how good we are down here in Wilmington." He said it was because we were used to playing against each other. It was true. We really didn't understand the level of talent we had on our high school teams. We could have combined those two teams, and a whole lot of college teams would have had trouble matching up. At the time, Gaddison was being recruited by dozens of major colleges as a football tight end. He might well have accepted a scholarship had he and his New Harrison teammates not taken Jordan's advice the next summer. They attended a five-star session, where Gaddison attracted the attention that led to a basketball scholarship with Old Dominion and then to a long NBA career. "In that sense, I owe my career to Mike. He was right," Gaddison said. "We didn't know how good we were." One thing that both he and Jordan did know was that they were headed to a major showdown that winter of 1980-81. In fact, since the close of the five-star camp, Jordan had eagerly awaited the opening of basketball season. He would attend Laney football games and watch his friends under the Friday night lights, but he badly wanted basketball practice to start so that he could get going and show off the things he had learned over the summer. Still, Ruby Sutton, who taught physical education at Laney, observed that the Jordan who returned that fall didn't appear much affected by his sudden acclaim. He remained the same happy-go-lucky guy, always ready with a smile, she remembered. As the season neared, Jordan did acknowledge in an interview with the Wilmington Journal that he looked forward to getting a thrill from the crowd's response to his slams, especially his theatrical sorties to the basket in the open court after a steal. "It inspires me to really play," he said. his energy fed from their energy, he realized early on. I enjoyed it to the point that I started to do things other people couldn't do, he recalled some years later in a conversation with John Edgar Wideman. And that intrigued me more, because of the excitement I get from the fans, from the people, and still having the ability to do things that other people can't do but want to do, and they can do only through you. That drives me. I'm able to do something that no one else can do. His signing with Carolina drew fans from across the region to Laney games that winter, Chuck Rhee recalled. When word spread how good Jordan was, Laney had to turn fans away because the gymnasium was so small and it would have violated fire marshal laws. Many of them wanted to be able to say that they saw Mike Jordan play in high school. There were long lines to get into the Laney gym on opening night, November 26, 1980. Those who got in saw Jordan score 33 points and seize 14 rebounds in a win over Pender County. It was the first of six straight wins to open the season, propelling the Buccaneers to the top ranking in the state. In the midst of this streak, Dean Smith consecrated the Buccaneers with an appearance at a game in early December. The crowd broke the Laney gym record for rubbernecking that night, according to those in attendance. The sighting convinced some of the naysayers about Jordan's suitability for North Carolina. More doubters were converted when he stacked up 9 assists to go with 26 points and 12 rebounds in a win over Kinston that same week. He also rejected 3 shots. Jordan just hypnotized us, Kinston coach Paul Jones allowed, pointing out that his players were so focused on Jordan that they left his teammates wide open. The true highlight of the season came in late December when Laney won the Christmas tournament at New Hanover's Brogdon Hall. It proved to be a physical rematch with his playground foes, now dressed in New Hanover's black and orange uniforms. Jordan was quickly snared in foul trouble that night and watched his teammates fall behind. With less than 5 minutes left, Herring sent him back into the game and watched as Jordan scored 15 points in a whirlwind. "All I remember is Mike taking every shot," Gaddison said. "I mean, we were grabbing him, holding him, pulling his jersey, knocking him down, and he still made every shot." The game came down to a final possession that found Jordan working the ball while looking to attack the basket. Then he took off. "I remember that shot he made in the Christmas tournament to beat us at the buzzer," Gaddison said. "I had grabbed his shorts to pull him down and then his jersey, and he still went up and made the shot." For the final season, Herring had cast aside all pretension and acknowledged that his main strategy was to get the ball to Jordan and encourage him to attack the rim. That approach mostly worked, because many nights Jordan was good enough to win games by himself. But by mid-January, the Buccaneers had 2 losses and were tied for 3rd place in the District 2 standings, hardly the circumstances to build confidence for a state title. "Laney often appears not so much a team as a group of players waiting for Jordan to happen," observed Wilmington Morning Star sportswriter Greg Stoda. The theme would surface again and again over Jordan's career. His displays of athleticism were so extraordinary, teammates and opponents alike would find themselves pausing just to watch him work. "We're getting better about that, though," Herring told Stoda, adding that the team seemed to play better at times when Jordan was on the bench. "But of course, I want to get the ball to him whenever possible. He's super." Jordan himself had initiated an effort to take things in another direction, one inspired by his hero. His vanity plates now read "Magic" on the back of his car and "Magic Mike" on the front, evidence of his wanting to perfect Magic Johnson's ability with a no-look pass. "It started one day in practice," he told Chuck Rhee, "when I started doing some freaky things like Johnson does. I made some passes looking away, and one of my teammates started calling me Magic Mike. He bought me the license tag on the back, and my girlfriend got me a t-shirt and front license tag with Magic Mike on it." He routinely gave up the ball to teammates, an unselfishness documented by the 6 assists he averaged that senior season. Yet it too often seemed that the ball was a hot potato for Laney, that his teammates were too eager to get it back to him. "If they're open, I'm going to pass them the ball," Jordan explained to Greg Stoda. "Coach tells them to shoot, and I tell them that, but I know they depend on me a lot." New Hanover's Hebron understood the other players' reaction. "Kids are awed by him," the coach acknowledged. "They're intimidated. Several coaches have told me that he's the best high school player on the East Coast. I've seen him walk into a gym for a pickup game and everyone else stop playing. This might sound weird, and a lot of people won't understand, but some kids are just happy to be on the floor with him. He'll go to Carolina and then maybe to the pros. Kids will be able to say that they played against him or on the same team as he did." "He was evolving right in front of our face," Gaddison explained. It wasn't about studying him because he did something new and different every game. He found a new way to beat you every game. Athletically, he was doing things that nobody had seen. He'd jump, and the rest of us would jump with him, but we'd come back down to earth. It didn't take long to realize he was cut from a different piece of cloth than the rest of us. Jordan buttressed those observations by averaging 27.8 points and 12 rebounds in carrying Laney to a 19-4 record that season. The total included three different wins over New Hanover during the regular schedule. Each defeat had left Gattison and his teammates vowing not to lose again to Mike Jordan. They would have one last chance in their fourth meeting that season in the district semifinals, the game that would determine which team went on to the state tournament. Played in Laney's gym, this deciding game seemed well in hand for Jordan and his teammates, who were up 6 points with under a minute to go. "We had been down as many as 10 or 11 points with a minute and 40 seconds to go," Gattison remembered. "There was no shot clock. All they had to do was dribble out the clock to close it out. Somehow, we came back to win that game. To this day, I don't remember what happened in the last 2 minutes. They could have dribbled the whole clock out. Somehow, we created turnover after turnover. It involved trapping Mike in some kind of way." Gattison would later wonder how they could have pulled off all of the pressing and trapping without fouling more. "On their home court?" he asked. With 7 seconds to go, the score was tied at 52 when Jordan made a move and launched a jumper. He was called for an offensive foul on the play, his fifth, which sent him to the bench, fouled out. The home crowd sat stunned. Gattison himself recalled being surprised at such a foul being called in the final seconds on Jordan's home court. New Hanover made the free throws to advance. The sudden turn of events left the crowd in a surly mood, not uncommon in high school basketball on the Coastal Plain. Just that season, New Hanover had won in Goldsboro, Gattison said. "I remember playing a game over in Goldsboro where Anthony Tichy went to high school. You beat those guys on their court, we had to stay in the locker room until the police physically could come and get us out." The game at Laney involved far more familiarity and shouldn't have been as threatening. People knew each other, Gattison explained. But Hebron was bumped by Laney fans walking off the floor. "When we won that game, we went in the locker room and coach said, 'Forget your showers, get your stuff and let's get out of here,'" Gattison said. "The referees were really who they were after, but there were no showers that night." As for Jordan, the unexpected end to his high school career was a profound disappointment. He had badly wanted to win a state championship. "He was really obviously dejected," Gattison said. Equally disappointed, Herring likewise had little to say that night except for this: "We reached for the moon and landed on the stars." In an interview almost 30 years later, Gattison's memory of the final game was still laced with regret. Although they would encounter each other many times throughout their careers, Gattison explained in 2012 that he had never once mentioned that final game in Wilmington to Jordan, no matter how relaxed or informal the occasion. Even after Jordan had won many pro championships, and it would seem that the pain had long eased, Gattison still considered the subject far too sensitive to broach. Likewise, Jordan would never mention it again either. And the players from the two teams would never again gather at Empey Park to go at each other. It was as if the moment had poisoned the innocent competition of their youth. They all knew how much it mattered to Jordan. "You got to understand what fuels that guy, what makes him great," Gattison said. "He took the pain of that loss. For most people, the pain of loss is temporary. He took that loss and held on to it. It's a part of what made him, and it made me. He beat me 3 times. 2 of those were in my own gym. Then we win the 4th game, and to this day I still feel bad about it." A few days after the loss to New Hanover, Herring boldly projected that North Carolina would win a national championship with Jordan in the lineup. But not many months afterward, the coach would begin his dark descent into mental illness. "Pop went years with people trying to help him," Gattison said of the bizarre reversal. "Everybody tried to do what they could. He just went years without the proper diagnosis, so he went years without the proper treatment. He just really spiraled down so fast. It was so debilitating mentally. The guy who was standing on the sidelines with all this fire in him, he became a ghost. Some years later, if you ran into Pop on the street, you didn't know which Pop you were going to be talking to. It was very sad. Mental disease is such a traumatic thing." Even so, Gattison said that Herring's legacy as a coach was Jordan's career, not because he kept Jordan off the varsity as a sophomore, but because of the many thoughtful decisions he made on Jordan's behalf. Back then in high school ball, it was almost an automatic. If you were 6'4", you were considered a big man, Gattison said. you were considered a center or a power forward and played close to the basket. But Pop had the wherewithal to really understand what Michael's talents were and to put him out on top of the floor at the guard position. So many tall players in high school are never allowed to develop as guards, and they often become tweeners in basketball jargon. A lot of tweeners at age 17 are 6'5 or 6'6, but they don't grow anymore, he added. Then going to college, they try to play power forward. They might even have good college careers and average something like 20 points and 8 rebounds. But when they go to NBA camps, they're expected to be off guards. And they've never played the position before, so they can't make the adjustment. They're done. Herring, however, had allowed Jordan to prepare for success at the next levels. Pop, he saw where Michael's future was in basketball, Gattison explained, and he made it possible for him to get there. Big Mac. Jordan's consolation that senior year was that he had been selected as one of Parade magazine's top prep players in America, but he was stung after the season when Buzz Peterson edged him out in an Associated Press poll selecting North Carolina's top high school player. We just played New Hanover too many times, he told the Star News 3 weeks after the season when asked to sum up his disappointment. When you play a good team that many times, it's bound to catch up with you. It's just hard to beat a good team 4 times. It was just their turn to win. Next on his agenda was his senior baseball season, but that was complicated by an invitation to play in the prestigious McDonald's All-American game. A new rule required North Carolina high school players to forfeit their eligibility if they participated in such games, which set up an immediate choice for Jordan between baseball and McDonald's. He took the team photo with the baseball team and appeared in the season opener, but it was a miserable, error-filled outing which settled the issue. To his father's great anguish, Jordan dropped baseball. I knew my mind wasn't into it, he told the Wilmington papers. The first of the McDonald's high school tournaments in 1981 in Landover, Maryland, pitted local stars against players from around the country. Ed Pinckney, a senior from New York, was one of the All-Americans who traveled down to Washington for the event. He hadn't attended the 5-star session with Jordan the previous summer, but other players from New York had been there and had returned home with stories about a really good player from North Carolina. Pinckney couldn't recall his name that March, but he didn't have to go to more than one McDonald's practice to figure out just whom they were talking about. He wasn't talking a lot, Pinckney recalled of seeing Jordan in that first practice. He was just playing. It was like, holy cow, when you're from New York, the mindset is that the best basketball is played in New York City. Well, the 2 practices we had completely changed my mind about who the best players were. Jordan may not have been talking smack to Pinckney, but he was once again to Patrick Ewing. He was talking he was going to dunk on me, the center recalled years later with a laugh. He was dunking on me. He was just talking trash. We were going back and forth. Surprisingly, Jordan was not in the starting lineup for that first McDonald's game, and Pinckney couldn't even recall who was coaching. It was Mike Jarvis, then Ewing's high school coach at Cambridge Ringe and Latin. But it was clear by the second half that the coach was determined to win. What happened, in the first half of the game, everybody gets a chance to play, he recalled. But in the second half, particularly down the stretch, the game was turned over to the skinny kid from Carolina. He got the ball and scored literally every time we came down the court, Pinckney said with a laugh. So it wasn't an issue as to when or if we were going to win. It was just a matter of where he was going to get the ball and how many he was going to score. For the record, Jordan scored 14 in that first game, and Buzz Peterson scored 10, a good enough performance to assure that the pair of North Carolina recruits started together in the backcourt of the National McDonald's game, played in Wichita 2 weeks later. It was the first big basketball trip for James and Dolores Jordan as well. Among the activities was an address from John Wooden, the legendary UCLA coach. Billy Packer, the former All-ACC guard at Wake Forest, who had become a broadcaster for CBS, also made the trip. Packer had been busy broadcasting the Final Four in Philadelphia during the first McDonald's game. Now that the big event was over, he had come to Wichita, in particular, to get a look at Jordan. Packer also lived in North Carolina and was a broadcaster for ACC games, so he was curious about any freshman coming into the conference. He was surprised at the strong level of talent in the game. The East roster included Milt Wagner, Bill Wennington, Adrian Branch, Chris Mullen, and Jeff Adkins. Audrey Sherrod, who had been named MVP at the first McDonald's game in Washington, was a hometown hero in Wichita and a big drawing card for the event. But Michael stole the show, Packer said. Jordan scored 30 points, a McDonald's game record. Best of all, he delivered victory when he went to the line facing a 1-1 with 11 seconds on the clock and his team down 95-94. Jordan calmly canned both. He put up extraordinary stats, hitting 13 of his 19 field goal attempts, making all four of his free throws and adding 6 steals and 4 assists. Yet at game's end, the three judges who had been selected to choose the MVP, John Wooden, Philadelphia Hoops legend Sonny Hill, and Morgan Wooten, the great high school coach from Maryland, selected Branch and Sherrod as the game's MVPs, despite Jordan's record-setting performance. According to some reports, Wooten did not vote because he was Branch's high school coach. Branch was headed to the University of Maryland. "We broadcast the game," Billy Packer recalled, "and of course when they announced that the most valuable player wasn't Michael, it was astonishing. It turned out to be Sherrod and Adrian Branch, who had played high school for Morgan Wooten. I know Morgan's integrity and Coach Wooden's as well. They obviously saw something I didn't particularly see in the game. But I don't think either of them would have stooped to, I'm going to pick my player no matter what. Adrian played fairly well too, but not as well as Michael did." No one was more furious than Dolores Jordan. She dropped her normal composure and let anyone within earshot know that her son had been robbed. Bill Guthridge looked up after the announcement and saw an obviously angry Mrs. Jordan headed for the floor with Buzz Peterson's mother in tow. The Carolina assistant headed them off and defused the situation. "His mother was furious," remembered Tom Konchalski. "She was very upset," Howard Garfinkel recalled. "I just explained to her that there's only one list that counts, and that's the night of the first pick of the NBA draft." Later that evening, Packer encountered the Jordans outside the arena. "His mom was still upset about it," the broadcaster said. "I was kidding with her and said to her, 'Don't be so upset about this game. Michael's going to be an outstanding player, and he's going to play for a great coach at North Carolina. Someday you'll forget this night he didn't get the MVP.'" Soon Packer would realize that while Mrs. Jordan might forget the snub, her son wasn't about to. Michael might have been playing tiddlywinks against Adrian Branch, and Adrian might not even realize it, Packer said with a laugh, but Michael would still have that image of that game in Wichita in his mind. Nobody in the ACC would realize just how motivated he was by things like that. But he never forgot anything. Michael and Sister Rosalyn graduated from Laney that spring of 1981 and began preparations for their next round of challenges in Chapel Hill. Laney's yearbook, The Spinnaker, detailed Jordan's curriculum vitae. Homeroom Rep 10, Spanish Club 11, New Hanover Hearing Board 12, Prep Club 10. The Spinnaker also included a passage acknowledging Jordan and Leroy Smith. "Laney only hopes that you expand your talents to make others as proud of you as Laney has been. Always remember Laney as your world." Jordan's world, of course, was about to expand exponentially, and every single soul, especially Jordan himself, would be stunned at how swiftly that happened. Part 4. True Blue. Chapter 11. The Freshman. Fans at opposing schools around the ACC always seemed to fixate on what they saw as Dean Smith's large nose and beady eyes. To them, he was a caricature, one that embodied an air of snarky superiority. This public image proved a radical departure from how he was seen inside the Carolina program itself, where he was held in uncommon esteem. In his players' eyes, his self-deprecation underscored his relentless emphasis on team play. "One thing I'll always remember is his honesty," NBA great Bobby Jones once told Sports Illustrated. "We all knew he had problems, just like everyone else, but most coaches would never admit to them. He also admitted he didn't have all the answers." That honesty provided the foundation for the deep respect and love his players so often expressed for Smith, particularly after they stopped playing for him, when he ceased being their coach and worked hard at being their friend. Michael Jordan would come to call Smith his second father, the sort of sentiment echoed by just about everyone who ever played for him. Sometimes Smith's efforts involved a major issue, such as James Worthy's arrest for solicitation of a prostitute during his days with the Los Angeles Lakers. "Coach Smith was the second person to call me," Worthy acknowledged, and he said, "We're all human. I know you're a great man. Just deal with it as a man." Smith got involved on less dramatic issues as well, such as problems in a former player's family or career. He had a prodigious memory, often recalling the names of his players' friends and relatives, people he had seen only once or twice. Lakers general manager Mitch Kupchak, who played at Carolina, was amazed once by a phone conversation in which Smith mentioned that Kupchak's sister Sandy had given birth to a boy. "He met my sister in the summer of 1972," Kupchak said. How could he even remember her name? Pete Chilcutt, another of Smith's players, observed that he frequently ran into NBA players who spoke bitterly about their college coaches or programs. That wasn't the case with North Carolina, Chilcutt once explained. "One thing all Tar Heels have in common is pride," which meant that Smith's players frequently returned to Chapel Hill during the summer to play pickup basketball or to gather for the program's annual golf outing. That family atmosphere paid off for Smith in terms of connections and recruiting. His program set the standard in the days when the ACC was viewed as the nation's best college basketball conference. Outsiders, however, did not share that reverence. Smith was often reviled by students and fans from other teams in the hotly contested conference. Part of what drew this contempt was his use of the four corners, the spread offense that became a signature of the North Carolina program. Rick Moore, a former high school player and basketball fan in Virginia, recalled the extreme disgust he felt as a teen watching Smith's teams play on television. "There was no end to my hatred of Dean Smith," Moore said. "You have some of the greatest players in the game on the floor, and he would have his team stalling out the clock. It was a curse on the game." Smith generally responded that the four corners gave his team its best chance to win, but few basketball fans seemed to buy it. And neither did the Atlantic Coast Conference, which pioneered the use of the shot clock in college basketball, largely in response to the four corners. For his detractors, it went beyond team strategy. Opponents complained that he was smug and self-righteous, a charge also leveled at UCLA's John Wooden. And like Wooden, Smith was viewed as excessively manipulative, working every angle of the competitive environment. NC State's Jim Valvano once joked that if Dean was complimentary of an ACC referee, the rest of the league's coaches would quickly blackball the guy. Irked once by what he perceived as Smith's manipulation, Duke coach Bill Foster seethed, "I thought Naismith invented the game, not Dean Smith." There was a gap between the man and the image he tries to project, Virginia coach Terry Holland once explained. A common joke around Charlottesville back in the 1980s was that Holland had a dog, a bitch, that he named Dean. It sometimes came across as though Smith felt he was above the rules. Holland recalled an incident. "He thought one of my players, Mark Iavarone, was roughing up Phil Ford. And at halftime, when the teams came off the court at the ACC tournament in 1977, he confronted Mark, physically touched him, and said things. That's one area where I think Dean always had a problem. He felt he had a right, in order to protect his players in his own mind, to confront other people's players. That's extremely dangerous and way over the line." "We've all probably done things we're not proud of, backing up one of our players," said Smith's rival, Duke coach Mike Krzyzewski. "But I can't think of a time I've ever heard him blame or degrade one of his own players, and in return, his kids are fiercely loyal to him. That kind of loyalty doesn't just happen. Things done on a day-to-day basis develop that kind of relationship." Billy Packer spent his share of afternoons observing Smith's practices, which were often eerily quiet as players hustled through the structured agenda. Every drill and scrimmage was precisely timed and measured and observed, all with the aim of sublimating individual prowess to the strength of the team. "Even in scrimmages, we've tried to apply that standard," Smith once explained. "If a player took a bad fadeaway jump shot and made it, I'd tell the manager, 'Score that a zero.' If he got a layup, it would be +3. We'd only have to score it that way a few times before the guys would realize what we were after." Detailed practice schedules were posted each day. As players ran through drills, managers stood on the sideline holding up fingers to indicate how many minutes were left in each period. The structure of Smith's program made possible all of the team's success that Jordan later experienced in pro basketball, explained Tex Winter, Phil Jackson's longtime assistant coach with the Chicago Bulls. "If Michael hadn't played for Dean Smith, he wouldn't have been as good of a team player as he was," Winter said in a 2008 interview. An overlooked factor in the Jordan legend is that Bill Guthridge, who worked for decades as Smith's top assistant, had played for Winter at Kansas State, then served as Winter's assistant. Winter, of course, had developed the complex triangle offense used by his Kansas State teams and later in the NBA by Jordan's Bulls. While the Tar Heels did not use Winter's triangle offense, they did employ what Winter liked to call system basketball, an approach based on a core philosophy and fundamental principles. Winter explained that many coaches used no such system, choosing instead to employ a freewheeling amalgam of various plays and isolated, often disconnected strategies. In Smith's program, the system was more important than individual talent. Chemistry also superseded talent. I think a very underrated part is the chemistry of a team and their confidence in one another, Smith once explained to Packer. And unselfishness in our game is huge. And of course, they have to play hard. We've always said, play hard, play smart, play together. And playing smart means you have to work real hard in practice to repeat things so you'll react even when the circumstances are disorienting, when fans are yelling at you, yet you still know what to do. With Dean, there was no stone unturned on or off the floor, Packer said. And when you take into consideration his total involvement as a coach, whether you were the lowly manager or a player like Michael Jordan, that to me was the greatest asset that he had. Smith was controlling in game situations as well, pointedly instructing his players not to engage in flashy plays that might show up an opponent. When Jimmy Black once threw an alley-oop to James Worthy for a resounding dunk late in a blowout win over Georgia Tech, Smith was furious and punished the transgression in the next practice. Carolina players simply did not contemplate such behavior. Yet he could just as easily offend others with his obsessiveness. I'm doing a game between NC State and Carolina, a big game, Packer remembered. I'm talking about two teams in the top five, and I'm ready to go out on the floor to announce the starting lineups. The teams are at their respective benches, and Dean walks by to me and says, "I don't appreciate your tie." And I look down and I have on a red tie. And it was the first time I realized I was wearing a red tie. I thought, that guy never stops. Here, the teams are getting ready to go out and play the game. How the hell could he be worried about what tie I had on? Packer admitted to often becoming annoyed that Smith would craftily use his post-game news conferences not for a frank discussion of the competitive proceedings, but to send messages to his players, even to the officials, and sometimes to opposing coaches and their players. I would always try to judge what he would say about the game when it was over, Packer recalled. He used to say things, and I would say, gosh, that's damn stupid. That wasn't the key to the game. It used to annoy me because it would be something that I hadn't even talked about on air during the game. He would make statements that would have underlying meanings. You eventually realized how smart he was and how dumb you were to not understand it. Thus, Michael Jordan arrived on the North Carolina campus in the fall of 1981 to find that he was about to play for a very different kind of coach. Where Pop Herring had been a blessing for his early development, the next stage of Jordan's journey brought a total immersion into the discipline of the sport. When you come out of high school, you have natural, raw ability, Jordan once explained. No one coaches it. When I was coming out of high school, it was all natural ability. The jumping, the quickness. When I went to North Carolina, it was a different phase of my life. Knowledge of basketball from Naismith on, rebounds, defense, free throw shooting, techniques. Even as he was recruiting Jordan, Smith had put together one of his best teams for 1981, featuring Worthy, guard Al Wood, and center Sam Perkins. Virginia had beaten North Carolina twice that season, and the two teams met again in the national semifinals in Philadelphia. Holland coached his team to go against Carolina's system. But Smith tricked the Cavaliers coach by uncharacteristically turning the offensive spotlight over to the athletic Wood, whose dynamic play helped win the day. It was Smith's sixth trip to the Final Four. From 1962 to 1981, his teams had stacked up better than 460 wins, with 9 ACC championships. The only validation he lacked was a national championship. His 1981 team lost yet another title game, that first Monday night in April, and had to watch Indiana coach Bobby Knight and point guard Isaiah Thomas take home the trophy, extending North Carolina's frustration another season. Afterward, his players gathered and vowed that the next season would bring an end to the drought. Michael Jordan watched the event on television, and for the first time in his life, felt a deep allegiance to Smith and the Tar Heels. He also felt a frustration that he wasn't able to help them against Indiana. I guess we can be like Penn State football, Smith mused after the Indiana loss, number two all the time. Comparing his program to that of Penn State's legendary Joe Paterno was Smith's way of asking for more patience from North Carolina's fans. Both Paterno and Smith had well-established reputations for doing things the right way, with an admirable balance between championship ambition and academic achievement for the athletes. He expected you to go to class, Worthy explained, and if you were a freshman, you had to go to church unless you had permission from your parents not to. He promised you that in your 4 years, you would graduate. It was simple, and his family philosophy was good. Yet it was hard to ignore the gnawing dissatisfaction among North Carolina's fans and the media covering the team. There was a sense that the balance that Smith brought to the cynical business of college athletics was not enough, that his insistence on doing everything the right way was preventing him from winning the big one. Neither Smith nor his assistant coaches, not even the players, talked about the growing derision aimed at North Carolina, but they felt it more than ever after that sixth trip to the Final Four. In truth, Smith had built the nation's best, most consistent basketball program. It produced the best players, who also finished school with a much clearer understanding of themselves as people. No one understood this better than the players themselves. Coach Smith taught us to be able to get along with people, Worthy explained. It helps you socially when there is a certain set of rules, when you have to communicate with people, when you have to learn to agree to disagree, when you have to submit to authority without losing your integrity. So it teaches you to learn how to deal with people and then how to rely on and trust people. Smith's structured system focused on the players doing all the little things correctly for one another, sharing shots and setting picks for one another, Worthy said, adding that you couldn't overestimate the value of Smith's elevated treatment of team managers and practice players. All of those things playing the game, they transfer over to life, he said. In turn, the players' allegiance to Smith and his mentorship made the winning of a championship vitally important to them all, Worthy explained. Some longtime observers actually took hope from a loss in Philadelphia. Smith had shown a willingness to open his system a bit to accommodate the special talents of a player like Al Wood. It showed that the coach was willing to adjust to a shifting landscape in the college game. Huge amounts of money and much higher levels of public attention were ushering in great change. In another few years, it might well have been impossible for a player of Jordan's special abilities to find his way into a system run as tightly as Dean Smith ran the program at North Carolina. Jordan, meanwhile, had liked much of what he had seen about the Carolina program on TV during the Final Four. He liked the camaraderie and the spirit and the talent. He figured that even though he was a freshman, he would find a way to come off the bench. If he managed to get in the games, Jordan believed he'd find a way to help the Tar Heels. Help indeed. 30 years later, on the eve of his own selection to the Basketball Hall of Fame, Ralph Sampson reflected on Michael Jordan, this force that had upset all of his best-laid plans and monumental expectations. No one had seen him coming. Sampson pointed out that Jordan's unprecedented rise all began with a piece of remarkable fortune. Jordan had been able to walk into a ready-made championship team at North Carolina, as if God himself had placed the reservation for him. He was very fortunate to be in that situation, Sampson pointed out. As a freshman in Dean Smith's system, Jordan merely had to fall in line. In all the years of Smith's program, only three other players, Phil Ford, James Worthy, and Mike O'Corrin, had made the starting lineup as freshmen. Like most programs in that day, Smith's system was heavily weighed toward seniority. He allowed his veteran players input into the rules of conduct off the court. He scheduled games in or near their hometowns during their senior seasons. He accorded them every conceivable honor and privilege because it was their four-year involvement and dedication that sustained the program. Freshmen, meanwhile, were lower, supposedly, than even team managers and training assistants. Freshmen carried team bags and equipment and performed other menial chores. It was the freshmen, not team managers, who chased down loose balls at practice each day. They had to earn a place in the program. Among Jordan's tasks that first year, for example, would be hauling the team's heavy film projection equipment around from venue to venue. Yet even that was part of the blessing. As a freshman, he faced no great pressure or expectations. Sampson, a tall, silent observer at 7'4", watched it all happen and with no small dismay. Virginia's 1981 battles with North Carolina had been the prelude to what would become known as the Jordan Era in Chapel Hill. Sampson had signed with Virginia, an ACC school in his home state with little basketball tradition, in 1979, and had led the Cavaliers to the NIT title in 1980 as a freshman. He was projected as basketball's next great giant, compared often to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and as such labored under tremendous media pressure and fan expectations. The 1981 Final Four loss to the Tar Heels had been a huge setback. But many in the national media projected that Sampson would carry the Cavaliers to a national championship in 1982. The greatest single obstacle in his way was the University of North Carolina, despite having lost talented senior Al Wood. The big question for Dean Smith that fall of 1981 was who would take Wood's place on the team. It was obvious that the 6'9 worthy was ready to step in as the team's top scorer, and Perkins, also 6'9, made for quite a weapon himself. Smith needed a wing to play heady ball, energize the defense, and knock down open shots when zones collapsed around Worthy and Perkins. Jim Braddock seemed like the likely candidate early in the fall. He was a junior, a fine shooter, and a decent defender. The other two candidates were freshman Peterson and Jordan. Peterson could run and jump and had speed. He wasn't a bad shooter either. Smith had been toying with certain thoughts since he watched Jordan's raw high school performances. But fans remembering the scenario would long roll their eyes. How could the Carolina coach waste time looking past the obvious? The answer was Jordan. Smith, however, was very much a man of process, and he had much to consider that fall. He had received early reports of Jordan from the pickup games he was playing with his new teammates and others around campus. Jordan's internship in the games at Wilmington's Empey Park had served him well, as had his childhood battles with brother Larry. As Bulls team psychologist George Mumford later pointed out, those heated verbal and physical exchanges with Larry set the format for how Jordan would relate to just about all of his future teammates. His game was rooted in the combat between brothers. Jordan's new teammates had no idea about the brother thing, although they quickly got a sense of the combat. As Worthy explained, Jordan seemed eager to bully the older players at North Carolina, and part of his bully game was talking trash. "I saw it then," Worthy said. "He had raw talent, and that was all he was. He came in very confident and seeking out the best in trying to target who he's going to dismantle." The freshman began telling his new teammates he was going to dunk on them. That irritated Worthy the most, it seemed. Others mostly laughed off his talk, but the behavior triggered a concern among the team's veteran players. They had vowed to return to the Final Four in 1982 to win a title for their coach. It was immensely important for them. The last thing they needed was a loud-mouthed freshman hotshot to wreck the team's prized chemistry. It wasn't that Jordan was oblivious to the team's desire to win a national championship. He felt a part of the North Carolina program and recalled his frustration and disappointment at watching the Tar Heels lose that spring. Still, he was a freshman that fall of 1981, and his aggressiveness was met with mixed reviews. "I remember that people thought he was really cocky or that he just talked a lot," Art Chansky recalled. And he wanted to have the nickname Magic. People in Wilmington had started calling him Magic. Dean said to him, "Why do you want to become Magic? Somebody else already has that name." If you look in the 1982 Carolina brochure, he was Mike Jordan. "What would you like to be called?" "They call me Michael." Dean said, "Well, we'll call you Michael Jordan from now on." That was the smartest move they ever made, because he became just Michael. Calling him Magic was bullshit. Dean was smart about that. Whatever his name, it soon enough became clear to the older players that Jordan had a boiling spring deep inside him that fueled his need to dominate. They saw that Jordan possessed a complex personality. In one sense, the trash talk seemed silly and innocent, but in another sense, it showed that he really was intent on challenging them. But his teammates soon began to realize that he was using the trash to push himself. The more he talked, the more he had to back it up. Jordan was not the first young player to do this. The difference was that he had the ability to back up whatever he said. Thus, Jordan immediately presented himself as a figure who could turn the world of Carolina basketball upside down. At least, that was how it seemed to Worthy. The new guy targeted Worthy for a little one-on-one as a measuring up exercise. Worthy sensed that Jordan was making an immediate play for his status and declined to be pulled into the freshman's mind game. In many ways, they were diametric opposites. Rather than mouthing off, Worthy tended to internalize things. It would take him years to learn to express his raw feelings the way that Jordan was already doing as an 18-year-old. So Jordan was a challenge to the older player on many levels. Physically, he was a scrawny kid, but strong and confident mentally, Worthy remembered. He had already surpassed a lot of people older than him. He had already reached that level of confidence. And it wasn't just their personal confrontation that mattered. All basketball teams are a hierarchy, Smith's teams even more than most. Jordan's youthful challenge had the potential to mess with Carolina's established team dynamics before the varsity even played a single game. "Oh, come on, big fella," Jordan would say to Worthy, trying to goad him into playing. It would take a while before he wore the junior down about the one-on-one. After he started to get better, he would pick on Sam Perkins and me, Worthy, with a slight smile, recalled in an interview 30 years later. He'd say, Let's play a little one-on-one. Finally, I did. We played 3 games, and I won 2 that I know of. The victory would confirm the program's hierarchy, although it clearly left Jordan unsatisfied, which was probably a good thing. Worthy mused that it took Jordan almost 30 years to admit the losses,